Well, welcome to the 32nd episode of Ideas and Lives. And we have a real treat for you today. We are sorry we had some delays in between 31 and interview 32, but we're getting back on it. We took a little vacation and we're going to, Zvi Bode and I are going to talk about, talk with Jim Rosenpep. State Senator Rosenpep. And so say hello, Zvi, my financial economist buddy.
Hello to Jim and everybody who's out there in the audience.
Okay. So I'm delighted that we have State Senator Rosenpep to talk with us today about his ideas in life. And we're going to start from the very beginning. So, Jim, first of all, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you. I look forward to it.
So, Jim, let's start. Where did you grow up? Tell us a little bit about your family background, early life, parents, sure. Any siblings.
Sure. Well, I was born in Rome, Italy. Lived there 8 months. I don't speak Italian, but it's a great story. But I do have connections to my family in Italy. I've visited with family in Italy over the years. My parents were American citizens, so I was born an American citizen. They were both journalists. And after World War II, they decided they wanted to live in Italy for a couple of years. So my father got a gig with the Journal of Commerce, which was the daily newspaper of the Port of New York. And in the early 50s, the Port of New York was as a bigger deal than Wall Street was. It was sort of the Wall Street Journal of the Port. So he became the Rome reporter for the Journal of Commerce. My mother got a gig as the Rome reporter for the Boston Globe. And they both had deals with the Saturday Evening Post and did magazine articles, traveled around Europe and did Saturday Evening Post articles. And so why was I born in Rome? Because that's where my mother was when I was born. And so they were only there 2 years. My older sister, about 10 years older, she was there. So my father learned Italian growing up. My mother learned Italian over the years, certainly living in Italy. My older sister learned Italian, but I never learned Italian. And so my parents basically used Italian as the secret language, so they didn't want me to understand something.
Like Yiddish for some of the Jewish kids.
Exactly, exactly. So at 8 months, we moved back to the United States. And we were at like a year in northern New Jersey, but we basically settled in New York. And so I was basically in New York for most of my childhood and beginning of my teenage years. We had
Manhattan.
But we spent 1 year in Cleveland, Ohio, because my father got a job that he only did for a year as the head of media relations and public relations for Case Institute. And then 1 year we lived in Boulder, Colorado, because my sister had some serious breathing and health problems. And the doctor said, go someplace where it's clear mountain air. And so we did that. So I was actually in the second grade in Boulder, Colorado. But basically then we came back to New York and I basically lived in New York as a kid through more or less the middle of high school. And during that period.
That's where you learn to speak Yiddish.
it's funny you say that, because one of the stories I always love to tell is growing up as a kid in New York, I thought about 40% of America was Jewish. I thought the other major groups were Catholic, and there was an African American minority and there was a Puerto Rican minority. I was not aware as a kid that most of the United States was actually Protestant. It was like, wow, that's so interesting.
Yeah. So you stayed until the end of high school?
No, not till the end of high school. I'm not going to tell you the long story, but fundamentally, my father got a job in Washington during the Kennedy administration. First couple of years, he commuted back and forth to New York. After my sister graduated from college and I finished middle school, my mother said, look, you love your job in Washington. Why don't we move to Washington, the Washington area? And so that's basically when she moved to Washington and I moved to Washington basically. And I finished up high school in Arlington, Virginia.
Oh, okay. And what was the job with the Kennedy administration?
He was the head of public information for the Internal Revenue Service. And people laugh when you say that, public relations for the IRS. He thought it was the greatest job in the world, because he was a New Deal Democrat. So he thought helping people pay their taxes was like the coolest job you could have if you were a PR man.
Okay.
It's the hardest job too.
Well, that's what people always say, but he thought it was just exciting and terrific and important, and everyone's a taxpayer and you're helping all these people. And so he had a different point of view. I think Bob knows I'm kind of an optimistic person. My father was way off the charts compared to me in terms of being optimistic and seeing the glass half full, not half empty.
So you finished high school and presumably went off to college?
Yeah. I went to Yale. And okay. But more interestingly, before we get to college and post college, because I think you're going to ask me about politics. So
at some point,
I got into politics when I was a kid. I still have today the poster for John F. Kennedy that I held in a parade on Broadway in New York when he was running in 1960, mm-hmm. and when I was 9 years old. And I have it in my attic.
Well, I rooted for him to run for vice president in 1956.
Really?
When Favre beat him out, but he made an impression on the convention.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, fast forward, I did some other work on some other campaigns in New York, but the one that was the most important to my life was in 1965, the late U.S. Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan ran for city council president in New York. Very few people remember that campaign. I walked into the campaign headquarters. I was 14 years old. The summer, I got out of school. What am I going to do for the summer? So I wanted to support him and his candidate for mayor, Paul Scrivain, and the controller candidate was Orrin Lehman. They had ethically balanced tickets in New York, very serious about this.
Yeah.
And so Moynihan was the Irishman, obviously. So I walk into campaign headquarters. In those days, you stuffed envelopes. You're a 14-year-old kid. They put you to work stuffing envelopes. So I'm stuffing envelopes. Second day, I'm there stuffing envelopes. Moynihan walks out of the office to kind of where I am with some other people. And he was 6 foot five. And I was sitting down. He looks down at me like this and says, "Hi, I'm Pat Moynihan." And I say, "Hi, I'm Julia Rosenfeld." And he said, "You want to come out with me as I campaign at subway stops and hand out flyers for me?" And that's the way you campaigned in New York, probably still do, but they certainly did then, because everyone's taking the subway. You stand there and you shake hands and shake hands and shake hands. So I went out with them that day, and it was very cool for me. At the end of the day, he says, "You want to do this tomorrow?" I said, "Sure." So he said, "Meet me in the lobby of my apartment building, 8 o'clock tomorrow morning." I did that for the next 12 weeks.
Wow.
Wow. I became his body man. And so I got him a cup of coffee. I got him the newspaper. I handed out flyers. I traveled all over New York City for 11 or 12 weeks with Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who is an expert on the economy, the sociology, the religions, the politics of all five boroughs. So he explained to me why the Hasidic Jews had these beards and these coats. He explained to me why there was a very popular German restaurant in Brooklyn. He explained to me how the Puerto Ricans fit in as a new immigrant group. And it was the most educational experience of my life.
Wow. And
unfortunately, he lost. but I stayed in touch with him over the years. He actually got me a job in the Nixon administration as an intern at the White House Conference on Children and Youth in 1969. And then I actually stayed with him and his family when I would visit Boston. And then as he became a U.S. Senator, as I went on with my career, I didn't see him that much. But generally, the last place I saw him was at the 1996 Democratic National Convention, because I always go to the national conventions. He always went to the national conventions.
Yeah.
And so we'd run into each other. I think it's the last time I saw him was we had a cup of coffee at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
And right. Was they are naming public schools in Boston for Daniel Patrick.
Oh, terrific. Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, that's
yeah,
great.
Yeah, just this week I learned of one. He was quite a guy and bipartisan, really. I mean, go ahead. You know better than I do.
He was bipartisan in the Joe Biden sense. He was a very strong, committed Democrat who believed in the principles of the Democratic Party and worked with Republicans to make deals that would advance the agenda that he believed in.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, well, okay, but there were some of the agendas that not all of his Democratic friends agreed with sometimes. So,
well, that's true, but not all Democrats agree with all Democrats all the time. And you may have noticed recently, not all Republicans agree with all Republicans all the time.
That's true.
I'm serious about this. I mean, the broad thrust of the New Deal, the broad thrust of social democracy.
Yeah.
That was Daniel Patrick Moore, and he believed in it deeply. And yeah. And he went to work for Nixon because he saw a target of opportunity.
Yeah.
He saw that Nixon wanted to do some things that could be consistent with that. And I mean, he wrote a whole book about it, about the guaranteed income.
Right.
And it failed, but he thought he could get that done. And he put a lot of his heart and soul into it.
Well, a person that I worked with at the Joint Economic Committee wrote a book called Nixon's Good Deed. And it was about SSI. So Nixon did nationalize aid to the blind, disabled, and poor elderly. And that nationalization did provide a floor that the federal state system did not. So
interesting.
Part of it was successful. So let's get back to you, and we'll come back to Moyer maybe later.
Okay.
So you went to Yale. What did you major in?
Economics. I'm embarrassed to say in this group.
Don't be embarrassed. Did you have James Tobin by any chance?
No, not at all. But what I do remember, and I actually quote this so much that somebody reminded me of, like in the last week, that in my Econ 101 class, I read a paper by Paul Douglas about how the minimum wage does not destroy jobs. And I've remembered that my whole life and quoted it to people and say, well, I don't know, you know, you may have your point of view, but I'm just telling you, Economics 101, Paul Douglas, it doesn't destroy jobs. It's a real boost for the economy. So that's my major memory of studying economics.
He was a real patriot. Douglas was a real patriot.
Absolutely.
So you majored in economics, and then what did you do after college?
Well, I did a lot of work in politics, as I said, in high school and in college.
Right. So you had already been, were you, so what, you worked on political campaigns while you were in college still?
Oh, yeah. And so I would say, what did I do most immediately afterwards? I guess I worked on the Hill. And so I worked for a member of the House. And I actually worked for a member of the Senate and the House. I worked for Senator Fred Harris of Oklahoma. Anybody remember that name?
Yeah, sure.
It's
a real populist.
A real populist and a fabulous writer. And he went on after he left the Senate to become a political science professor at the University of New Mexico. And wrote the book that is accepted across academic places in the United States on Mexican state politics. But when I was working for him, I was basically a speechwriter for him. And I'm an okay writer, but he improved my writing so much editing the drafts that I would do for him. And he wrote a number of books separate from the academic book about state government in Mexico that are just so well written. But that's kind of what I mostly remember about that experience. But basically, I worked in politics, I would say that. And then when Carter got elected, a whole bunch of friends of mine went to work for the Carter administration. One of them became the PR guy, like my father, for Ray Marshall, who was Secretary of Labor.
Ooh.
And so they hired Ernie Green to be the head of ETA.
Yes.
And they wanted a PR person for ETA, for the Employment Training Administration. And so they tried to recruit me to join the administration
to work for Ernie Green.
Yeah, to work for Ernie Green. So I got to know Ernie Green, became great friends with Ernie Green. And in fact, we then, after he left the administration, he and I ended up doing business together. He graciously came to the inaugural party we held in my state Senate district when Barack Obama was inaugurated. And he was like just such a rock star. Among African Americans. Anyway,
well, I might have gotten to know you then because
you were there.
I worked for Arnie Packer, who was,
I know,
for our audience, Arnold Packer was the Assistant Secretary for Policy Evaluation Research and worked with Ernie Green on a lot of different things. So
exactly, I met Arnie during that period of time, and Arnie and I remembered that when we got back together like 8-9 years ago in Maryland.
Yeah.
But I didn't take the job. I worked as a consultant to them for like a year or so. But I basically wanted to go into business. And so I stayed in touch with them politically, but a friend of mine, well, let me back up. Along the way during this period of time, I fell in love with my wife, Sheila Cass. We celebrated our 40th wedding anniversary this year.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
And because I was interested in business, both from the point of view of doing business, but also from the point of view of business relations with government, and which kind of gets you to apprenticeships at a certain point, but also includes regulation of business. I worked on a lot of those issues and still do. I thought about going to business school. And so I applied various places. The only place I got in was Carnegie Mellon. And so it's in Pittsburgh, but I had fallen in love with Sheila, who was working in Washington for the Washington Star and had a great job. And I said, why don't we drive up to Pittsburgh and see if you'd like to live in Pittsburgh for 2 years? We drove up to Pittsburgh and it was beautiful. It was terrific. And she said, I don't think I want to live in Pittsburgh for 2 years. I don't want to leave my job. And so I said, okay. And so I contacted Carnegie Mellon and said, I don't think I'm going to come this fall, but I might come in the future. Can you keep me on the whatever list they have for people who don't show up when they invite them? And they said, sure, we'll keep this open for next year. So next year comes and I have the discussion with Sheila. What do you think about going to Pittsburgh now? She said, no, I don't know. And so I chose love over graduate school and never went to business school and have had a terrific marriage and stayed in Washington. And a guy who she covered for the Washington Star, a guy named Jim Stone, was chairman of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. He had formerly been the banking commissioner the insurance commissioner in Massachusetts at the age of 26.
Wow.
And right. And he is a great guy. We've become very great friends. He and his wife came to our wedding. But in any case, Sheila introduced me to him and we hit it off immediately and just kind of became friends. And then one day he calls me up and says, I've got a friend who was the banking commissioner under Dukakis in Massachusetts, who under the Carter administration was the head of the National Consumer Co-op Bank that the Carter administration set up. And she was going to say to leave, but had some ideas about putting together, basically doing investment banking for co-ops and other nonprofits, and wondered if I'd be interested in talking to her. So I did. I got together with her. We hit it off. And we created a niche investment banking firm where she was the brain and I was the pretty face. And we basically did investment banking for nonprofits, not very many of them, but for nonprofits that wanted to do tax transfer deals. Because you remember the beginning, this was the Reagan administration, is they passed those incredibly ridiculous tax cuts of accelerated depreciation, that just money was going out the door. And she figured out at the co-op bank how to do deals that allow nonprofits to take advantage of them by selling the tax benefits. And so we put together a little business. I recruited a bunch of other people to it. She recruited people to it. And between, I would say, 1981 and 1986, we did three deals. We did a union office building in the Northwest. We did a college dormitories in North Carolina. And most interestingly, we did the historic rehabilitation of the Newark, New Jersey train station. And in 1984, the Reagan administration basically says, we're going to do comprehensive tax reform that would wipe out these incredibly generous tax benefits. And so we were like, oh, this business is about to be over. And so we closed deals. We worked with transition rules. While all these other people in real estate were like, oh, that'll never happen. That'll never happen. They kept getting in deeper in 1985 and 1986. And I mean, this, I want to give myself credit. I'll give Carol Greenwald credit, who was my partner. He was like, no, we got to roll this down. Punchline is, we closed it down. We actually made a bunch of money from the three deals and basically decided to pocket our winnings and then go into direct investment with other partners in other deals, which is what we did over the years and I'm still doing.
And the name of the company is what?
It's changed over the years. Today it's called Patuxent Capital Group.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Okay. So you're able to do that kind of on the side. You've been in politics all this time, but not in elected office.
Well, I wasn't in elective office until 1982. I got elected to the Democratic Central Committee in Maryland in the early 80s while I was doing this business. I was involved in campaigns. I mean, I worked on the Carter reelection campaign. In 1984, I was involved in the Mondale campaign. But in 1986, a Maryland House seat opened up. And so I ran for that and got elected to the Maryland House of Delegates in 1986 and served in the House of Delegates from 86 until 97, when I stepped down to become ambassador to Romania.
Yeah, yeah. So what were some of the highlights of that
87 to 97, basically.
87 to 97, period. Were there any interesting highlights or?
Well, there are lots of interesting highlights.
Well, tell us some. We're all
I'll tell you one or two.
Our ears are open.
Well, one is that I live in College Park and did then, and I represent where the University of Maryland is. And lots of public employees at the University of Maryland. In 1991, we had basically the Bush 1 recession. And so we had significant fiscal problems in the state like everybody else did. And at that time, I was the chair of the tax subcommittee of the Ways and Means Committee. And I was on the Ways and Means Committee the whole time. William Donald Schaefer, who'd been mayor of Baltimore and was then governor, was persuaded by somebody that he should eliminate the 35-hour work week for state employees, which had been there for decades, and go to a 40-hour work week without changing compensation. Mm. And it just created a huge uproar, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And a whole bunch of us were pushing against it. And, you know, I was a junior House member, and he was like William Donald Schaefer, the former mayor and governor, and had a well-earned reputation for being a tough guy with a soft heart. And so I had never gone to him myself for anything because I was, there are 141 House members, so my leaders would kind of deal with the governor. I mean, I knew him and he knew me, but I had so many freaked out pink collar workers at the University of Maryland who had built their lives around the hours they had to go to work. And so I said, it's worth a shot. So I asked for a private meeting with Schaefer, which he gave me. And I met well with them. And I said, look, I understand what you're trying to do. I'm not here to argue the substance of 35 hours with 40 hours. And you clearly are locked in on this. And there are a lot of people who are supporting you on this. And there are people who obviously wanted to get rid of 35 hour week. But you announced it on such short notice that people who have to take care of children, people have family commitments, people who live where they live, all based on how to get to work. At least don't put it in effect immediately. Give everybody a year's notice. And he looked at it, looked at me, thought about it, and said, son, you're right. and he moved the thing off for a year. Now, that sounds like not much, but it's one of my most memorable experiences as a member of the House of Delegates, was something that was really important to thousands of working people.
Of your constituents.
My constituents, but beyond my constituents and beyond my constituents. And I was able to actually affect their lives in a positive way. So that's what I remember mostly when you say what's the most memorable thing during that period of time. We did other things too.
During that time and in general, the legislature meets
3 months. It meets 90 days, 90 calendar days.
A certain number of months, correct?
It's in session for 90.
Only 3 months, okay.
Yeah, 90 days.
So you would be a little shocked if the governor said, we're going to make the House be in session for 230 days.
Right, starting tomorrow, right. Absolutely. Yeah, exactly.
So most other legislators, as well as you, would have to have other professions alongside their political activity.
Yeah, and most do, but they're exceptions, which are wonderful exceptions. One of my colleagues, when I got to the legislature, he was entering his third term at age 30. He'd been elected to the legislature when he was 22.
Wow.
And we've had really young ones over the years. He was one. And so basically he went to law school for 3 years while he was in the legislature. Mm-hmm. So they're young people in that situation. But then I have a number of colleagues who are over 80 years old. They're all my favorite people. They're terrific people. And I work with them very closely. But the one that my favorite story is a guy I served with in the House of Delegates. He is now 84, 85 years old. He retired from the agriculture department like 30 years ago, whatever, or 25 years ago, and devoted himself to public service. He served in the House of Delegates with me. Then he served 2 terms on the county council, and he's term limited. And then in 2018, at the age of 80, he ran to be a freshman senator. And served one term and decided last year he was going to retire again. But he's all involved in all kinds of things. So it's all over the map. Most people.
Well, maybe it's not too late for Tzvi and me to get in.
Absolutely.
I was always interested in politics, but I stuck to economics. But anyway.
We'll serve on the committee for ideas and lives.
Yeah.
How's that?
Well, when I was in college, deciding I had always liked political things. But when I was in college, I had an older brother who had majored in political science at the University of Chicago. And I was thinking of either economics or politics as a major.
Uh-huh.
And he said, take economics, you need an instructor more there. But politics, you can read those books, but economics, you do need an instructor to help.
That's an interesting insight. One of the things we have in Maryland that's unique in the United States is an allocation of scholarships from the state that are given out by legislative district, and the senators and delegates get an allocation where they can make the decision of who gets the scholarship.
Wow.
And so when I got elected, I, how do other people give them out? How do they decide? And some of them don't want to take the trouble, and they give it back to the state scholarship agency. Say, you figure this out, some of my district. Other people, including my mentor and predecessor in the state senate, he set up a committee of citizens who would interview all the kids and make recommendations to them. And then there's some who do it themselves. And there was an African-American senator from Prince George County who was a real dynamo, controversial like dynamos tend to be, who, when I went to visit him to talk, not about that, it turned out it was during his scholarship interview period. And he personally interviewed every applicant for a scholarship. And he would decide, can I help this person? What other scholarship help does this person need? I mean, it was so personal and hands-on. It was Tammany Hall at its best, and literally at its best. He knew people, he was helping real people, his constituents, with real things. Anyway, I get to be a senator, and I do that for the first 2 years. I interview everybody. And I want to get a feel of who they are and how it works and everything. And there was this one Indian American girl who was a very good student. She was a good student in math. She went to our tech high school. And I asked her what she wanted to major in college. And she said, political science. I said, oh, that's great. Why do you want to major in political science? Because I think it's a good way to make money. I said, not legally. Look at something else. You might want to focus on your math skills. Anyway.
Okay, so now you're a fixture in the Democratic Party. You've been to all the conventions. You've already been elected. And how did it come about that Mr. Clinton designated you as ambassador to Romania?
Well, this is where I'm going to put in the plug for my book with my wife, Dracula is Dead, because it tells the story in detail in the book, but I'll summarize it for you. I knew Clinton a little bit from 1980 because I was active in the National Democratic Party and I went to a couple events and I met him. Fast forward to 1992, which was actually the year that I had that conversation with Schaefer about protecting the pink collar employees at the University of Maryland. I was tied up in the session. And actually, my first choice for president was Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa, who was a good friend. And I put together his campaign in Maryland, and he had dropped out by the time we got to the end of my legislative session. And so Clinton's campaign manager was an old friend of mine, David Wilhelm, who I called up as soon as the session was over. And I said, my session's over. I'm happy to help Clinton. I can't go to any state. I got to work for a living. But what can I do to be helpful? And he said, Italians. And I said, Italians? He said, I know you're active in the Italian-American community. And we got an Italian problem. I said, oh, well, what is it? He said, you remember the Jennifer Flowers tapes? I said, yeah, I remember the Jennifer Flowers tapes. And he says, you remember where she says something like, Mario Cuomo seems like a mafiosi, and Clinton says something like, uh-huh. I said, actually, I don't. I was focusing on the sex in the tapes, but I'll take your word for it. He said, well, you may not have noticed it, but Italian Americans, Sons of Italy clubs across the country are angry. I got a stack of angry letters. Our chairman in Rhode Island, the most Italian American state in the country, the newspaper urged him to step down as chair of the campaign. His house was picketed, and I've done nothing about this. Would you figure out what we should do with our Italian problem? I said, sure. So I called up my friends at the National Italian American Foundation, the two Democrats here. It's mostly a Republican organization, but my two Democratic friends, and said, this is a problem we should help Clinton with, but it's also an opportunity for the Italian American community to help him. And so they said, the place to start is go see Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut, who I did not know. And they set up for me to go see Rosa. I meet with Rosa, I explain the problem, and she's thinking about all the angles. And she says, here are the people you need to talk to. One of them was Frank Guarini, who was kind of the dean of the Italian American Delegate. He was from Newark, New Jersey. And there were several others, and Nancy Pelosi, who was that was only her fifth year in the House. And that's where I met Speaker Pelosi. So I go to sit down and I talk to them. I say, look, we got this problem. What do you think we should do? And it was basically brainstorming. Out of all those conversations, the members of Congress plus my other friends in the leadership came up with a three-part plan. Number one, when Clinton would be asked during the campaign what kind of person he'd appoint to the Supreme Court, presidential candidates get asked that all the time, he should say someone like Mario Cuomo. And that was number one. Number two is he should commit now to speak at the National Italian American Foundation dinner in Washington, which was about a month before the election. And third, we should put together a prestigious Italian Americans for Clinton Gore. So I go back to Wilhelm and I say, here's the plan we got. What do you think? He said, I got to talk to the boss, but I think we can do this. We can definitely lock in his schedule for that. Absolutely, go put together this group of notables, and I'll see if he's willing to say. He came back and he said, the boss is on board. And from then on, that's what Clinton did when he was asked about the Supreme Court. And fast forward, I get with all the folks. We put together the leadership committee with Pelosi, and Peter Rodino was still alive. And Jerry Ferraro was still alive. And there were a whole lot of notables. And there were lead Democrats in the leadership of the Sons of Italy and in the National Italian American Foundation. So we put together, we decided to do the announcement of the thing on the afternoon of the dinner in Washington and have a press conference with Clinton, with everybody. So it gets scheduled and have a great press conference, lots of coverage because the national press follows the presidential candidate in the last month, anywhere they go. But as I said, the National Italian American Foundation is mostly Republican. The dinner had 3,000 attendees from all over the country. It's a great organization and still is. So he does it. He gives a great speech, as Clinton really always did. I don't think I ever heard Clinton give a bad speech. He gave too long a speech at the 88 convention. People started saying, let's get it over with. But he gave great speeches. And so CNN reports that night that 3,000 Italian Americans gathered in Washington tonight to endorse Bill Clinton for president. Who never forgot that? The Republicans and the leadership of NIAF and Bill Clinton. So anyway, we'll make the story a little shorter. So he gets elected and they ask me if I'm interested in doing something in the administration. I said, I'm not interested in going into a full-time job. I like the legislature. I like my business, but I'd love to do something that's part-time. And by that time, my wife, Sheila, and I had gotten very interested in the collapse of communism in the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe. And so I said, I'd love to do something that's part-time border commission dealing with former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe. And by that time, in 1991 or 1992, I was the first chair of the Maryland Sister State Committee with the Leningrad Oblast in Russia and done a bunch of exchanges and done a bunch of stuff. Anyway. So they come back to me and say, this is a friend of mine who's a deputy personnel director, comes back to me and says, and he talked really fast. He said, how'd you like to be on the board of the Romanian American Enterprise Fund? I said, that sounds great. He said, okay, I'll call you back. That was the conversation. And so he calls me back a week later and he says, Romania's gone. How about the Albanian American Enterprise Fund? I said, sure. And so I was on the founding board of the U.S. government set these up on the Bush administration, Clinton, all over Eastern Europe. $30 million, USAID, volunteer board of directors. I ended up being chair of the investment committee because of my financial background. And we were the biggest investor in Albania for, you know, quite a number of years. So I did that during the first Clinton administration. And then after the second reelect, we worked on it, blah, blah, blah. They came back and said, what are you interested in the second administration? And I said, at this point in my life, and Sheila's situation, I said, the only thing I'd be interested in other than staying on that board would be an ambassador someplace in the former Soviet Union or Eastern Europe. And my friend, different friend, who was the, I guess, the deputy personnel director, said, okay, fine, but everybody wants to be an ambassador. I said, I got it. You asked me what I want. I'm just telling you what I want. If I don't get it, I'm happy to stay doing what I'm doing. He said, okay, we'll put you on the long list. So I said, terrific. And then, like months later, I was at the Italian embassy at a dinner and ran into John Podesta, who at that time was deputy chief of staff to the president. Yeah. And he says, come on over here. I said, sure, what's up? He said, do you really want to be an ambassador? I said, yeah. And I thought he was going to let me down easily and say, I'm so sorry, but can we do something else? He said, well, you're actually on a short list and you need to get a bunch of information to us. And then you need to meet with the person who's doing it. And so I said, okay. And this was in my legislative session in 97, when I was vice chair of the committee and had huge negotiations going on related to a tax bill and to school aid. I canceled two meetings with this White House staff person because I thought it probably isn't going to happen and I got to do my job in the legislature. So I finally go and meet with her the week after the session ends and sit down and say, here's my stuff, blah, blah, blah. And she says, the president would like you to be ambassador to Romania. And I said, did I miss the beginning of this conversation? And I called Sheila and said, you're not going to believe this. So that's how it happened. It's a long shaggy dog story.
So you get to Romania.
Yep.
And you explain it in your book called
Dracula is Dead.
Dracula is Dead. And I'll ask you a little bit afterwards whether Dracula is still dead. But
that's not this a was, question.
This was the period where those regimes were becoming more democratic, correct?
Yeah, but that understates it. I was there when it had become democratic. It was a gradual transition, I would say, for about a year and a half before I got there. After 1989, 1990, 1991 was, you would call it a gradual transition. By the time I got there in 1998, it was democratic. I'll tell you a story about that. So within a couple of months of being in Romania, one of the things I would say is how terrific, so impressive how Romanian democracy is. And Romanians would always say to me, oh, no. We're nothing like the United States. You don't understand. We're not really a democratic country. It looks democratic, but then really. I would say, why did it seem democratic to you as a Romanian? And they'd say, well, first of all, the members of parliament are always arguing with each other. Number two, the press writes whatever it wants, whether it's true or not. And third, the politicians, they're only worried about the next election. And so I developed this riff in Romania saying, I would tell the story over and over again. I'd say, I'm the U.S. ambassador. I'm here to tell you, that's as good as it gets. And it's good because the members of parliament can argue with each other. They couldn't argue with each other under communism. The press writes whatever it wants because it can. They couldn't do that under communism. And politicians are worried about the next election because there is a next election.
Wow. So how did you view your job there? And what did the State Department tell you to do? And how did you view your job?
I understand. Well, I always say it was a really easy job because I was the Italian-American ambassador to Romania under Bill Clinton. And there are strong cultural ties between Italy and Romania. When I was there, the largest number of investments in Romania were by Italian companies. Romania is one of the five Romance languages. And so being Italian-American was like a huge, like they gave you the benefit of the doubt. Secondly, Bill Clinton was extremely popular. At the height of impeachment, remember in 1999, there was a poll in Romania that I sent to the president that showed him with a 91% approval rating in Romania.
Wow.
And we tell this story in the book. During that same month, it was January of 1999, I toured all around the country all the time, and I was visiting Iași, which is in the northeast part of, and it was really the home, they call it the city of synagogues. It was kind of the core of Jewish population, although there were Jews all over Romania before the Holocaust and after the Holocaust. But it was called a city of synagogues and serious Jewish population. And I visited with the Jewish community there and everything else when I was there. But I also visited with the Roman Catholic church there, which was building, rebuilding. They wanted to be shown around and so forth. At the end of the tour and talking about the congregation, the priest takes my hand and says, Mr. Ambassador, I have a favor to ask of you. Well, when someone in Romania asks the U.S. ambassador for a favor, it means someone needs a visa to the United States. and so I that's fine. I'm prepared for that. You know, I expect that. It's nice that people want to come to the United States, and that's all plus. He says, please give a message to President Clinton for me. We appreciate so much what he's doing to bring peace between Israel and the Arabs. And I said, I definitely will pass on that message. And I did. But that was a period when he was doing a lot of stuff related to peace in the Middle East. But the point of this, my story is, the president of the United States has such a big brand. And when the president of the United States is doing something that people think is good, it makes it easy to be the ambassador for that country and for that president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. Now, did you have any differences with the State Department over the years, over the couple years?
I did. But the most interesting one was, and I'm very proud of this, I believe I'm the person who brought the internet to the desks of ambassadors for the first time. When I got there, I had been using the internet as a civilian in the United States, you know, in the mid 90s.
Yeah.
When I got to Romania, I had a cable machine, like they talk about State Department cables, cable machine on my desk, and I had a secure computer. I couldn't access the internet in my office. And so there was one internet accessible interview in the embassy compound in the basement. And the only two people who used it was me and a young economic officer. And so the problem with that, I had it at home, I could use it at home. But the problem is you couldn't access newspapers. So what the State Department people were used to was buying the International Herald Tribune 2 days later at the hotel. And this was in 1998. And I was like, this is insane. I'm happy to do all my newspaper reading at night, but I got to kind of keep up with what's going on in the world, you know? So I talked to my deputy and I talked to my tech guy and said, there's got to be some fix to this. And they were like, I don't know, these are the rules, blah, 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 blah. And so, but then my tech guy came back to my deputy to me and said, I got an idea. Ambassador, if you're willing not to have the secure computer on your desk, and just the insecure computer, I can switch them out for you. That's technical related to how the waves travel, all that kind of stuff that I don't really understand. And so I said, I think that's great. So my deputy, who was a career Foreign Service guy, great guy, very innovative, he said, I get it, I'm for it, but let's not do it without telling Washington we're gonna do it. He said, let me do this. Let me call the head of admin for the European Bureau, who's a great guy who I'd met, he's a guy, I call him a guy like Gorbachev. He was part of the system, but wanted to change the system. And so he loved to fix problems. So my deputy, Mike Einick, was just brilliant on this and other stuff. So he sends a cable to Washington saying, he talks to Don Hayes, the guy in the Bureau. He says, here's the plan, what do you want to do? And so Hayes says, here's what you want to do. You want to send a cable saying, Ambassador Roosevelt wants to do that. We're going to do it in 8 weeks. And he said, if you do that, it will set off alarm bells all over the State Department. And I will be able to say, oh my God, we got this rogue political ambassador. We got to figure out a fix to this system. And so he took it on. And I don't know, 8 weeks later, there was a worldwide cable that went out that said, yeah, you can do it.
Oh. Go ahead. I want to make sure we get in a little bit about coming back to Maryland and getting your interest in apprenticeship started. And so you finished Bill Clinton. Gore did not win.
Right.
So that meant ambassadors would sort of resign.
Come home. Yeah.
Okay. So
So what happened was the Bush administration let us Clinton ambassadors serve past the change in government because they were nice guys. I always say that the height of compassionate conservatives under Bush was directed at Clinton ambassadors. So he let people stay. Clinton threw out all the Bush One people on January 20th, but Colin Powell was secretary, and they said to us, look, if you have a reason to stay longer, let us know, but if not, be out by March 1st. And many of my colleagues stayed 6 months in so their kids could finish school in the place they were. But we didn't have kids in school, so we left March 1st. Governor Glenn Denning of Maryland, who was governor then, who was a close ally of mine, who had come to visit, he and his wife had come to visit us in Romania. And he called me up one day and said, how'd you like to be on the Board of Regents of the University System of Maryland? And I said, sure, that sounds great. And so he appointed me to the Board of Regents. And so literally the appointment went forward before I'd come back from Romania. And so I come back from Romania and I go for my first Regents meeting. And so I was on the Board of Regents for 5.5 years, which was great, very interesting. Then in 2006, I ran for the state Senate, and I've been in the state Senate ever since. That's kind of basically what's gone on the political front.
But when you first came back, you were focusing on the business a bit more.
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, as my father would say, not with admiration, I have a short attention span. And so one of the things I always say about the legislature, both on the floor of the Senate, in the House or Senate, and in committee, is most of the time is wasted. And so the way I and some other people get around it is we work on other stuff. So while people are droning on for no apparent reason, like I'm doing other business online. And so I focus when I need to, but if there's no need to, I mean, if they're debating some issue I know nothing about, my constituents don't care about, I'm not being influential on, it's like whatever. I concentrate a lot, as I do on apprenticeships. What I care about, I concentrate like a laser beam. But I got interested in apprenticeships back in the 90s. I can't remember why, but I started reading up on apprenticeships in Europe. And so I introduced legislation in the House in the 90s to promote apprenticeships starting in high school. And I worked with the then head of career and technical education, the State Department of Education, who was really into it too. And we got no support. It was like crickets. And so I said, okay, this is going nowhere. So I gave up on it then and didn't come back to it until, and the turning point in Maryland was when Bob Lehrman testified before the Augustine Commission in 2014 and made the pitch and wowed the crowd. And so one of the five recommendations of the Augustine Commission on Economic Development, not on apprenticeship, not on workforce, not on social policy, on economic development, one of the five recommendations was create a youth apprenticeship program. And so because it had such an imprimatur, this commission, the new legislature comes in, the new governor comes in, it's like, we're gonna do youth apprenticeships. And so I was like, wow, okay. So I dug into it.
So it's back.
Exactly. So I'm like, okay. I mean, in the legislature, and it's like business though. You know, you see opportunities, you pursue them. And if you fail, you move on to the next opportunity. And so that's kind of how that happened. And I worked on that. And as I've said repeatedly in your presence, it's basically been a failure, but I learned from it. And so now we're moving forward with a whole lot of initiatives that I think are going to be a lot more successful.
So tell me how you're able to persuade fellow state senators, House members. You seem to have gotten to know a great deal of them, a large number of them. And what's the process?
Well, the process is
it a one-on-one process? Is it?
It's totally one-on-one. So people kind of make fun of me in the legislature because, and I've done this since I was in the House, I try to systematically have lunch or dinner with every new legislator just to get to know them, see what they're interested in. And most other legislators don't do that. Most other legislators, I have close friends and folks who are not close friends at all. But it's easier in the Senate because we're only one third the size of the House. But when I was in the House, I knew every House member to some extent. And in the Senate, I definitely know every senator. And so I try to understand what they're interested in, what they care about, and offer to help them. I mean, that's part of it. It's got to be reciprocal. I'll have constituents who will say to me, I like you a lot. You're terrific. You care about the community, but I really disagree with your vote on this. And I say, well, that's fine. I appreciate it. I don't agree with all my votes. Why should you agree with all my votes?
Yeah. Yeah. And when was your hardest election?
Oh, it was definitely my election to the Senate in 06. I ran against a Democratic incumbent and beat him in the primary. But he had money. He was a hardworking guy. And I beat him in the primary by 20 points. His Republican friends got him to switch parties. And they took out the sacrificial lamb. I have a Democratic district. They got the sacrificial lamb Republican candidate to withdraw. Then they made him the Republican nominee. So he was running against me in the general as a Republican, and I'd beaten him in the primary as a Democrat in the same year. And he had money again, tough campaign, and I beat him again by 20 points.
Yeah, interesting, because you might expect that he would get some of his old Democratic votes that he had had, plus Republican votes.
Maryland. Well, no, but the way to think, it's an interesting point you make. I mean, he did get some of those for sure, but the reality is, by 2006, in my district, as well as across the country, things had become so polarized that it's difficult to get people to cross party lines. I voted for him in the primary when he was a Democrat, but now he's a Republican. Go away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And since then, you've been able to hold the seat.
I've been able to hold the seat despite my record.
And... and do great things for Maryland.
Thank you.
So I can't close this without thanking you so much for helping develop Apprenticeships for America.
Oh,
the governing board. And for those of you that don't know, Jim is a huge champion of apprenticeship, and we're in this together to make apprenticeships great again. So we really thank you for taking the time. Tzvi, you have any parting thoughts?
Well, I think we're going to need apprentices to take the place of full-time workers.
All
sorts of fields. That seems to be the case.
Yeah, we're going to get into as older workers retire. But we do have our signature parting phrase, which is
Sei gesund.
Sei gesund.
Yiddish
for
be healthy.
Keep well.
Be healthy. Well, thank you very much.
So the next time you come to one of your Jewish events, you can say Sei gesund, and they'll really enjoy it. So
I will do that. But I just want to say before we sign off that, Bob, I really appreciate your friendship and leadership and advice on all this. When people sort of say in this apprenticeship, so where does Lerman fit in? Where do you fit in, Jim? I say, he's the brain and I'm the muscle. So it's been a great partnership. It is a great partnership.
You're understating your role. But anyway, upward and onward, and Sei gesund.
Sei gesund.